RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
Another World of UX podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thanks everybody for taking the time to join us on today. And as always, a special welcome to those of you who are listening for the first time. Don't forget, spread the word, tell folks about it. It is time for quality content to go viral. All the crazy stuff's going viral, but it's time for things that folks actually find useful and helpful to go viral. So tell folks about the podcast. We'd appreciate it. The UX community will appreciate it. Today, we are going back to our Talkin' Shop repository, if you will. Well, it's not really a repository. It's a repository from the perspective that the people that I have on the show, I've interacted with them in some way, form, or fashion over time. But I had an interaction with somebody who I've been connected with on LinkedIn for a while, and it hit me. Gotta have this guy on the show. This guy has a lot of great things to say. And part of what I want to do with the show and what I have been doing is help to provide more access to the masses, to people who have something to contribute to the discipline, not people who were trying to make a name for themselves, not people who are trying to become celebrities, not people who just want to be heard, not people having a narcissistic fit, but people who actually have something to say, something that vaults us forward. I want to help everybody go forward. The people I bring on the show want to help everybody go forward. And that said, I want to introduce my guests, and as always, have my guests tell you who they are. But today, joining me on the World of UX, I have the one, the only, Roshan Ravi, all the way from Bangalore. It's late where he is. So welcome everybody to Roshan Ravi. All right.
Hey, thank you, Darren. Roshan, thank you so much.
Tell everybody who you are. It's introduction time. Tell everybody who you are and what you do.
Yeah. So thanks, Darren, again for inviting me to the podcast. It's a real privilege. You are somebody I actually look up to. It's a real privilege to be here. And I tell everyone that I'm primarily a designer. So that's what, who I am. I actually started in 2003 as a, graphics and web designer and using Flash and, those things, Microsoft Front Page and, all those kind of things.
Front Page.
you remember those? that's my origin story is actually, and then, sort of, kind of started, got introduced to accessibility. So that's where, you know, I got into user experience because I was working on a lot of freelance projects and I was also taking care of a website for a company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a regulatory kind of need, they wanted to introduce the accessibility into it. And then, you know, sort of I started, you know, learning about it. And then, you know, Section 508, AA and AAA standards were not that popular at the time. But, you know, at least Section 508 was like people was kind of going for that. And that's when I got introduced to the accessibility. And then learned about usability eventually, yep. And then sort of started getting into, you know, user experience and things like that. Even then, people did, you know, they were not calling it user experience. It was just usability, basically, right. You know, like right. How you use it, you know, problem solving and things like that. So that, and, you know, that's what I did for a long time. And then, you know, eventually kind of ended up with organizations like Sapien, Adobe very, very recently, and then, you know, EY, Ernst & Young, Hewlett Packard Enterprise. And currently I am one of the WPP company, you know, WPP is an organization that yep. owns sort of Ogilvy and things like that.
I'm an alum. All right. Yep.
Oh yeah. Oh, nice.
We have a couple of crossing points there, because I used to run the word processing department for Arthur Young before it became Ernst & Young, going all the way back to 1984.
Wow.
Yeah. Told my age again. There we go.
Yeah. That's the reason I said, you know, I look up to you, people like that, and you know, Debbie and people like that, because, you know, it's one thing that, you know, you can actually show the flashy designs and things like that, but yeah. It's another to sort of back it up with the real experience and, you know, things like that. But, you know, compared to, you know, I would still say I'm still not. I come from a design background, but you know, for a long time, I understood the value of doing research and things like that. And now that I'm in a position, in a leadership position, I'm a, you know, sort of associate director, head of design for this company. So, you know, sort of, I kind of am able to kind of instill those values in our teams.
Nice.
You know, sort of make sure that, you know, we hire the right people, and we don't, especially don't say that UI, UX and things like that. Right. Yeah. Yes. So that's my sort of, you know, experience in a nutshell.
That is dynamite. And I mean, I love hearing about someone's experience. You know, I mm-hmm. I forgot we had those crossing points, because you WPP, I was WPP through Team Detroit, which is now, then it became Global Team Blue, then it became VML YMR, bought the whole thing. So, you know, we were all under one roof doing work for Ford Motor Company from 2007 to 2010. Nice. I was there, and very proud of the information architecture that we did when Ford.com was, they merged the shopping site into the corporate site. And then they, we were part of that. I helped do that.
Okay.
And then I'm so proud. And I tell people all the time, the information architecture that my partner at the time, Jody Bollert, and we actually worked on the information architecture that is pretty much still intact. We did that in 2010 and we nailed it.
Yeah.
And that information architecture has changed very little since 2010, because it's that good, because we nailed it. They're doing some other things that are not so great, but, you know, whoop-de-doo.
Yeah.
But I love hearing about the background. Yeah. I love hearing about a couple of things you said there stood out to me. Of course, the UI UX thing, but you said something else that's really great that I wish more people would do, because a lot of companies are not really, they don't seem to be interested in, and it's not a common practice, to hire somebody that really knows what they're doing to run UX teams, to run UX operations. Yeah. And you mentioned making sure to hire the right people, because there's so much fallout. When you don't hire the right people, you have a bunch of people. Some of us were talking on LinkedIn. I don't know if you saw this. This was yesterday or earlier this morning, actually, talking about how that there's an article that someone did for UXPA. And it reminded me of my series on So You Want to Be a UXer. And they were talking about the personality traits that are needed to thrive UX. Oh my goodness. And one of the things they mentioned that my new boss was telling me about that article And that's why I'm like, I got to share this. This is dynamite. Because they said neurotic people, you have to make sure that the people you hire, just focus in on that, because I don't want to get too far off the beaten path here. We got a whole list of things to ask you about. But neurotic people don't make good UX folks. And how many people know what neurotic is? So that means that we have to go, we have to look. The people who are easily upset, the people who their feathers get ruffled easily. Don't we see people whose feathers get ruffled easily on social media? Don't we see people who get upset all the time on social media, but then they're mad because they can't get hired? Hey, you're not ready yet. You have every right. Everybody has every right to pursue. If they want to be in UX, you have every right to pursue it. We're not trying to stop that, which is another reason why that whole gatekeeping accusation that hits people like us is not even accurate, because we're not trying to stop anybody. We want you to do it the right way. But when you're neurotic, you got to lose that. You can't get upset easy. Oh, and the big one, and I'll jump right back to this. I thought you might have some comments on this as well, but people are, self-doubt is a major fruit, if you will. It's a major tendency, characteristic of neurotic people. But self-doubt, so people keep labeling themselves as having imposter syndrome, which doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But self-doubt does, which is life. However, if a person is sort of immersed in self-doubt and not trying to build, I mean, if you have self-doubt, which we all had at any given time, the question is, how do you respond? If you don't have confidence, what then do you do to counter that? And so when you're find out where you're short, find out where you need to improve. Don't see it. And I mean, what's your take on this, Roshan?
So I think I believe I've shared, something along these lines a few months ago, actually. People were talking about every conference you go to, there will be somebody talking about this, imposter syndrome, right? I mean, and as a person who's been doing this and then who is actually not from, I was not trained as a user experience designer I really loved this and then got into this and then learned things myself. And then I had good mentors, people who can actually help me learn the things that I wanted to learn.
Yep.
And the thing is, if you have self-doubt, and if you have a good, mentor, you go to that mentor and then, how do I do this? You need to have that relationship. And one of the biggest problem that I actually see, and I've conducted so many interviews, I think probably like hundreds, probably, 200, 300 interviews that I've actually taken for, people looking to get into user experience, right? So, and then one of the things that I've seen, especially in the, and this is not, I'm not bashing the young people or, things right, like that, right. But I do see that actually a shift, people pretending to know a lot of things. And then when getting challenged, they don't want to accept it. And then, so I see that actually. And those people will have those imposter syndrome or whatever they want to call it, right? Because they're not able to go and ask somebody, hey, how do I do this?
Yep.
On the other hand, I have a very young, person that I'm actually mentoring. She's only like 3 years in experience. And I think two of those years were in visual design, not even in user experience design. So every time I have those conversation, I kind of tell her that, and she's very confident, and there are certain traits that actually makes her a good UX, a UX practitioner. Mm-hmm. And she wants to learn about the research. She knows the value of the research and things like that. And those kind of people can they don't feel the imposter syndrome because, they can actually call up somebody. Yeah, they can call up somebody and then, hey, I'm having this problem. I'm actually doing, trying to figure out how to, do a certain thing. How do I do a heuristic evaluation, for example, for a website?
Yep.
So then I sit down and then, just there is somebody to guide her, and she can, she has built those relationship not based on egos and things like that. So that kind of helps, I think.
Yep. Absolutely.
And yeah, I think, and about the imposter syndrome, right? I think it's an overused word, too much of it. Actually, I've heard a lot of podcasters, especially design podcasters, not naming any, but you know, people actually have been actually selling that point for a long time. And, I think it had its good run. I think it's, a good time that you give it a rest and then, just, learn things properly.
Exactly. I mean, when I did my blog post on that topic, say, here's the history of it, because people accept it, but they can't even tell you where it came from. They heard it, they accept it, they run off with it. Why do people just grab everything that comes up? Everything is not a legit thing. So I kept hearing it so much that I had to go dig into it. I'm not going to just accept this as if it's a thing, because if it's not a thing, I mean, that's what we're taught to do. That's the academic mindset. Right. You hear a concept, and it's part of my doctoral studies, but it exists before you reach the PhD level. When you hear a concept, you investigate. Critical thinking, which happens to be at the core of what we do as UX people. Yeah. How in the world can you just accept something at face value? You have to dig into it. And when you dig into the topic, it's very easy. It doesn't take much effort to find out this is not really a thing at all. Yeah. And at the end of that blog post, I mentioned, if you feel like you have self-doubt, if you lack, you just said it, you lack confidence, call somebody, get an answer. I mean, if you see a wrinkle in your shirt, you take out an iron, you press it. If you eat some food and you see something in your teeth, you get a toothpick and you get it out. The nail in your tire thing that I use a lot, if there's a nail in your tire, you take it to the tire shop and you get it taken care of. But all of a sudden, when you see a flaw in you from a UX perspective, you want to get a ostrich effect bias, stick your hand in the ground and pretend it's not there. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work. It hurts you, the person who does it. It hurts the team. It's going to hurt the perception of the team with leadership. Yeah. It's going to hurt the brand of the team within the organization. And then it eventually trickles and it impacts the UX discipline at large. And which is why some companies have such an easy time laying off UX people, because they don't see value.
Yeah.
If UX is bringing this proper value, we're not going anywhere.
Exactly. Yeah, I you bring up a very important point here. And I think, I just wanted to add there, the imposter syndrome that so far that I've seen, if your team is strong, right? And I worked with, a large organization, I'm not naming it, explicitly, but it's not the organization's, fault either. But, there were people there as head of designs, or people who were who are not from the design background. For example, there was somebody who was there who came from a front-end development background and then did some design thinking courses and things like that, and then got into this and then got promoted and then became and if you look at that team, right, what will happen is that you hear them saying like, we have this imposter syndrome. You can see her kind of, giving speeches about, see that person kind of giving speeches about the, the imposter syndrome and things like that, so so I think the problem is that, and prior to, I don't know, maybe 2014 or something like that, nobody was talking about imposter syndrome
at all.
And I worked out like, at all, right? I mean, that's not even 2014. I think it was probably, it's only in the, the recent 2018, 2019 that, people started talking about the imposter syndrome. Before that, like, everybody did their job. If they had a doubt, they, asked the team. It's only this sort of, when you have, the leadership that is not as strong and they're not able to kind of inspire people or empower people, that's when, you start to seeing the imposter syndrome sort of, cropping up.
Yep. Yep. Man, there's so much we could almost do the rest of this and just talk about it. Do that another time. We'll do that another time. But let's get back into let's get back into Roshan's track here. But that's good stuff.
Sure.
Definitely good stuff, and somebody's gonna benefit from that. So you mentioned, you introduced yourself, you talked about how you got into UX. I think you may have touched on this a tad, but not much. Mm-hmm. How did you develop? Speaking, and that's a good segue, actually, because people, they have this, they feel like they have imposter syndrome. The antidote to that feeling is to go and build your acumen. That's what you do.
Yeah.
How did you build your levels of expertise that you have today? What are some of the light bulb moments that you had and the things that happened to you that helped to vault you forward?
Yeah, I think, in my case, it's like I have been upfront about what I don't know. Whenever I join an organization or anything, you know, like if I did not know how to do research, I would say that, you know, hey, I'm not a researcher. I come from a design background. You know, that's my job, right? So I can do, you know, interaction design and things like that whenever I was actually doing those, right? So it's I would be upfront that, you know, these are the things I don't know. I'm willing to learn and I want to learn, because I want to know, because I have a very curious kind of a mind. I learn about different things. So naturally you sort of, there will be a lot of people who are actually sort of willing to sort of mentor you in that case. Because if you go there with an attitude that, you know, I'm here to learn, I value, you know, whoever your senior is, you know, your mentorship, I think that will kind of help, right? So I think that's where I have to, you know, say this also, because at the time when I was actually kind of, working in these organizations as, you know, like junior to senior designers, I was not, the user experience was not really that prevalent, or like that discipline was not that prevalent in India, right? So I think there were only very few people. So I was lucky to sort of reach out to them and then, you know, sort of start learning from them and, you know, things like that. I think that's probably the only way that you can actually, and if you keep your ego out and then, you know, if you commit to learning things properly. And I also used to, you know, kind of think, I think we probably, when we actually sort of connected on LinkedIn, I think I probably commented on one of your posts about this actually, because I was not aware that, you know, the negative implications or effect of using UI UX. For example, the word, right? Because, you know, I used to see that all the time in India, people, you know, like UI UX, UI UX. And then I kind of naturally started using that also. But then, but then when you sort of explain through your posts and things like that, you know, so that's when I realized that's not, you know, it makes sense. So if you kind of, you know, learn from things that are happening around you, follow the right kind of people and, you know, value the mentorship and then, you know, people who have more experience than you, I think, you know, that's working on the, and not just learning, you know, applying those things that you learned on the real job also, right? So that's another thing. So, and you know, if you can do that, I think that's how, you know, I did it. Now there are a lot of, design schools and, you know, organizations actually providing trainings. But when I was, you know, when I came up, there was none in India, to be honest. I think there was no, you know, nothing that was actually doing that user experience design as a, you know, as a discipline. Yeah.
Yeah. You sent me down memory lane a little bit there, because when the first time I heard UI UX or UX UI, was when I, in 2013, when I went to work for Cengage and National Geographic Learning. Mm-hmm. And I came in as a contractor, the only time I've ever contracted as a UX professional, and was because I was really looking for something. And I went ahead, I made the plunge, and I really wanted to work for that company. So but people were always trying to hire me. So I had somebody who I got offered two jobs while I was a contractor. Mm-hmm. And and Cengage is like, oh no, we love you. You're not going anywhere. And when I got promoted, my title was senior. When I got hired full time, I should say. You'll see it on my LinkedIn profile, senior UX UI designer. Mm-hmm. I thought nothing of it. So that's the first time I heard it ever. Whoop-de-doo. I don't care. I was so happy. And I think a lot of people they're guilty the same way. They don't know that UX UI is an issue. I wasn't even thinking about it. I didn't even consider it. Yeah. I also wasn't really talking a lot about UX. I was a completely unknown entity except for where I worked. But as I continued to grow and continued to learn and I continued to advocate for the discipline, and I continued to embrace the fact that we are all ambassadors of UX. When you really think about it, I can no longer allow myself to just sort of opt in and just ride along with this, to the extent that I began teaching a course in 2014 or 2015. Okay. It was called UX UI, What's the Difference? Matter of fact, it was 2014. Okay. It was I got that role. and it was for me to, the whole purpose of the course was to help people understand what the difference is between the two and how you can't use that acronym. So I sort of like 2014, if I remember correctly, that was when it might've been late 2013. I have to go back because I got the dates all jumbled up, but it's right there. And this is not going to work. We can't do this. And then I began to even become more adamant about it because I started to observe more and more instances where the combo was being used and how the mindsets of the people using it, the impact of people using it. And then I just went. So now I've got a huge soapbox where I'm always talking about it and I elaborate. I think I'll go back and redo that class or turn it into a talk and just put it up on my YouTube channel because it's really dangerous and people have absolutely no idea. They have no idea.
Yeah,
and I'm going to.
So
the UX UI thing, really critical that we understand. I may even have a couple of people on them because I want to start doing more shows too. Video, because this is, of course, the audio, but I want to start doing more video on these and we can do that and talk about it a little bit more. But back to the list of questions here. What is your fondest memory as a UX professional? I know we've all got our little warm, fuzzy moments, things that make us feel really, really good. What comes to mind for Roshan?
I don't have one single memory to sort of, you know, kind of particularly pinpoint, but I think it is more of, you know, sort of how I was able to kind of help a lot of designers get into the profession properly, you know.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people that I have, you know, like hired over the period of, you know, like, I don't know, last 7 years or something that, you know, so I think I was able to kind of help a lot of people who to get into the profession, you know, by learning the right things and things like that.
Wonderful.
A particular one that I kind of stood out for me was last year, I think it was, I was, you know, like again, hiring, you know, one person and then, there is a very well-known design school here, and people pay a lot of money in India to study there. And then, you know, like they come with this kind of, this is how you should do the research and things like that. So, you know, so there were a lot of instances where, you know, a lot of red flags, right? So, you know, secondary research, passing, you know, people passing secondary research as primary research, for example.
Whoa.
They just Googled something out and then, you know, found something not even from, you know, sort of reliable or verified sources. And then they sort of, you know, hey, this is the research we did. So, you know, so I was able to kind of, you know, So my philosophy is that if you have an acumen, if you're a critical thinker and if you are able to kind of check your ego, you know, outside, and then you are able to kind of listen to what we are actually talking about, then I think you have a future in UX, right? So I think that way I was kind of able to kind of guide a lot of people to get into UX profession, and I have that relationship with quite a lot of people. So that has been kind of, you know, one of my fondest thing that I have actually done. There are other things also, but then, you know, it's all project related, and I'm not really kind of able to say, you know, sort of what those are and things like that, and name props and, you know, stuff like
problem.
That. Yeah.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best decision you ever made as a UX? What comes to mind? It might not be the absolute best, but which one comes to mind for you?
I think that would be to sort of, okay, there was a financial, not a financial, insurance related project that I was actually working on. And, you know, I was sort of like a creative director or like, you know, UX director kind of a role for that. And we were sort of getting a lot of, stakeholder interviews and things like that done, right? One of the best decisions that I made, I think, is to get, because, you know, the stakeholders are in North America. So one of the best decisions that I actually decided was that instead of me doing it, I think it should be somebody in the US. One of the things that I learned is that cultural, getting the right people to do the right job. If you get, for example, if you are actually, there is a gap. If your researcher is from a different culture, right? For example, you are not able to sort of understand or ask the kind of right questions properly. So for me, I lived my whole life in India. Right. So it's I've traveled to US for, you know, many times. That's, you know, that's besides the point, but still I'm not able to understand the culture of the West as much as a person who is actually from the West. Mm. Right. So I think it is important to put the right person to do the research, even if it's somebody who is a sort of, you know, doing the research, even if you are the person who is actually preparing the, you know, sort of protocols and things like that, but still that will make an impact. And then I did that, you know, sometimes back, and then I kind of I make it a point to, you know, for example, if I'm doing a project that is for Hong Kong, for example, I tend to get a person, you know, if we don't have anybody, we'll definitely get a person from that particular area to you know, ask the questions and, you know, do the research. And that makes a lot of change a lot of difference in the way that, the people respond to the questions and things like that. I think that's something that I've learned quite recently. I mean, not very recently, but, you know, something that a good learning sort of, you know, because I always thought, you know, hey, if you learn the tricks, you can do it yourself, but that's not the case. Actually, I think there is this cultural aspect there. Yeah,
that's a phenomenal point. And when you say that, you remind me. Of course, we come across a lot of people. I want to get into UX research, and they don't understand what UX research really is, especially the academics coming in. But it's not just them, and of course, I'm not picking on them. I'll say that for posterity's sake. Mm-hmm. But people don't understand. Research has to be designed.
Yeah.
You don't just, I mean, and people will say, yeah, I just want to go in and ask them what they like. You know, we always have the thing that seems to have come to an end, excuse me, on social media, which design do you like better? There are people who are doing that and think that that's research.
Oh yeah.
You know,
which UI is better.
Yeah. Or asking, what do you want in your design? And then, well, I want A, B, C, D, E. Okay, good. My research is done. No, it's not. Matter of fact, everything you did is a complete wash because you don't ask people what they want, and behavior is better than sentiment. And people don't understand it. But yeah, you just remind me of that. And I wish more people, we're going to be doing a show talking about that very soon too, because research needs to be put in perspective so that people understand what it is. And one of the things with the academics that comes up a lot is that I've seen a lot of academics who get into UX research, they get frustrated because of the timing that's involved. They're used to doing an academic project, and you can take anywhere from 9 months to 3 years to do that. Well, guess what? You're not going to have over here.
No
time at all. You can forget all of that. So you have to be able to move quick. You have to be able to pivot. You have to be on a dime, and you can't miss a beat. And that catering to stakeholders, things of that nature, if folks are not ready for that. And so we'll be talking about that at length. Somebody's actually gathering questions from academics, and we're going to be answering all of those questions. But
I just want to add a point there, actually, to about the cultural thing. This was actually, it's not my experience, but I have a friend who actually works in the government, there is a government agency that is actually sort of building websites and apps for the public sector, the government sector, things like that. So he works there, and then they were actually building an app for tribal people or a remote village kind of a population, and a problem is that majority of them don't know how to read and write, not even in any language, basically, let alone English, right? So they used to search services, they used the search icon, right? So that magnifier icon. So, and then they tested it with the users. So what happened was that the people were asking, what's this dish doing here, because they have never seen a magnifier in their life. So that kind of a thing, right?
Wow.
So because it looks like a not a dish, but sort of like a frying pan. A pan or something like that. Pan, right? It looks like a frying pan. So like, what is it doing here? What does it do? So that's a question. So there was an interesting thing, because culturally, if somebody hasn't seen that thing, the magnifier glass, you never know what it does.
Wow. Yeah. You remind me of when I did my master's thesis on the evolution of the hamburger menu. That's my master's. That's what my master's thesis was on back in 2015. And it was funny to print out icons on 11 by 17, just for these large icons, and just hold them up and ask people what they thought icons were. Icons only, no text. And but specifically, of course, everything else was like a distraction, because we really just wanted to know what they felt about the hamburger menu. And when these people, different ages, if I remember correctly, the people that I tested ranged from 25 to 72. And when the older people saw that hamburger menu, what is this? Oh, it's three lines. That was it. Nobody had any idea. Now, it's readily accepted today, and it had to become evolved where it was accepted within our digital world, so to speak, and people would understand it. But in its inception, terrible. Just terrible. Moving on to the next question, though. What is your biggest, what is your biggest regret that you've had as a UX professional?
I have a lot. So many.
Feel free to string them together. Go right ahead.
So my biggest regret, I think, is that not learning, research and, the research-based design early on. Because I've made a lot of terrible websites and designs for people during the beginning of my career, right? So it's all because and I did not have the opportunity to learn those also, because India, like I said, in India UX was not really something that people did,
right.
You know, because India was mostly, you know, like developers and, you know, engineers and things like that. So the designers never had the chance there. But, you know, but I think that kind of, I think I lost probably 5 years of my career, you know, just not knowing user experience properly. Right. So, and I was kind of, yes, usability was a thing that I was actually doing, but still, you know, the aspect of, you know, understanding the problem and then doing a user research and, you know, like the importance of doing the, you know, the testing and things like that, that was never, you know, something that I understood in the beginning. So I think that was probably the biggest research. And if you look at my career also because of that, I've had opportunities to become sort of, you know, a manager or, you know, like in a management role, you know, even before, but I always kind of thought that, you know, I was not ready for that because, you know, I was still learning, see, because I didn't want to be, you know, somebody who didn't know how to do things and then, you know, pretended that, you know, you know, you can do these things. So I think because of that, I think I probably lost like 5 years or 5-6 years of my career because of, you know, not learning things properly. So I think that's probably the biggest, you know, kind of regret that I have.
That's huge. That's huge. And I think everybody can benefit from something like that, no matter where we are, because there's people that are 10 years, 15 years and have things that they don't know. I mean, why not learn it? I'm about to do a project about toolboxes. What's in your toolbox? Really? Is it like the guy we used to joke about, the guy who would come in with a, back in the day when you did see people carrying briefcases, and the guy had a briefcase and nothing was in it but a sandwich. There's nothing. There's nothing in it. I don't want to be that person. I never wanted to be that person. If I have a briefcase or a toolbox, and the briefcase is the business person's toolbox, essentially, in a sense. Not fully, but in a sense, what's in my toolbox? What can I, if I'm coming, being brought in to work on something, what tools, because my ability to help is going to be limited to the tools. And today when we think tools, people think, they hear the word tools, they think Figma, you know, they think Azure, they think Qualtrics, they think tool. No. What methods, methodologies, techniques, deliverables are in your toolbox. And when people, we can shift the thinking and get people to understand that those are also tools. And of course, the greatest tool we always talk about this is the human mind. And some people, their mind is not even in their toolbox. They don't even, you know, it starts and ends with Figma for a lot of people. And that should let somebody know that they're actually tool deficient and they need to shift out of that. But I'll get off of that soapbox real quick. What has been your biggest challenge?
So, and I think we are kind of similar in a way that, you know, I change jobs very frequently. The most that I have worked in organization is like 2 years or 3 years probably. So I think for me, my biggest challenge is suffering fools. I would say I would, you know, and I've it sort of manifests in a way that, you know, like, I'm not naming any organizations, but, you know, recently joined a company and then a huge company, prestigious company, people kind of look forward to kind of joining that company. And I quit that job within 3 months. My biggest challenge is sort of, you know, like when my first instinct always is to kind of, hey, correct it. You know, this is not the certain way, you know, this is not how you do certain things. But then if they're not acceptable to that, my biggest challenge is to continue to kind of pursue doing that.
Yep.
I would probably just, you know, quit. So that has been there, and it is still there actually. So, you know, if projects and things like that, they're not able to understand, you know, where we are actually kind of coming from. I will try my best to sort of, you know, oh, hey, you need to do the research, you need to do the testing. Even if you say that, you know, you don't have the budget, you will suffer later if you develop the whole thing, you know, but if they're not able to accept it, then, you know, my interest goes down and then, you know, I quit sort of, you know, so I stop caring. So that's a problem. And it's a bad, it's a problem because, it's a problem because, you know, career wise, if you look at it, it just, you know, it feels like I'm jumping around. Right. But, you know, and then and that also kind of affects the sort of stability of the job. So I think that's probably is my biggest challenge. And I still suffer, you know, sort of, not able to do about anything about it, actually.
Right. If it helps at all, and I think some people need to hear what I'm about to say too. I cannot find this article. There was an article that I saw roughly 4 years ago, and it mentioned that it talked specifically about the shelf life of a UX practitioner, and really likened the years that a UX professional stays at a company to dog years. Isn't that something, that to stay at a company for 1 year for a UX professional is really almost like being there for 8 years in another role?
Right. Yeah.
That's really what it's like. So I think the longest I've ever been in any company as a UX professional, I believe, is roughly 3.5 years. My freelance aside, that doesn't count because I was in charge. So, but, and I was, I was leading everything, but I mean, there's an element of self-respect that comes into play. I know a lot of people that stay at a company, the UX maturity level is bad. They're not valued. They're not understood.
Yeah.
They have to fight all the time. And the funny thing is, these are younger people who are the ones that are more willing to do it. So they don't know that I almost died because of what was happening to me at one company I worked for. And that really changed my perspective, Roshan, tremendously. After being in the hospital, I never stayed in the hospital a day in my life until that. And I always, my joke, the way I jokingly present it, I can joke about it now because I lived, but I always joked that there were four parties and each had an appendage and they were all pulling two legs, two arms, a marketing department that wanted to control UX and didn't even know I had been hired. And so they continued to execute on their plans to commandeer UX, even though they had no knowledge of UX, nobody, no practitioners, no nothing. But they wanted to control the UX. So they had an arm. My bosses, who were my boss and my boss's boss, who were afraid to deal with the politics, unskilled and afraid to stand up to the marketing department. So they were being manipulated and they weren't really providing me any support. They had another arm. There was a technology partner who was mad because of what I did, a heuristic analysis, and let him know that his baby was ugly. Which I really didn't. This is what you can do to improve. I mean, it's known that you have a successful product, but if you do this, you can take your user experience even further and you can greatly improve your product. Your heuristics are outdated. There's no such thing as an outdated heuristic, especially when you do it right, which I did. Yeah. So they had a leg because they wanted me dead because I said their baby was ugly. And then there was a creative partner who had been hired to do the user experience. I was the first UXer that was hired full time. They were mad because they were being backfilled by me. So they tried to create problems for me on every hand. They had the other leg and everybody. So I had no support. I was on an island by myself with no support, trying to drive success of a product that had been rolled out. It was going to be the seventh or eighth product rolled out to the people at that company, the users, and the prior six or seven solutions that had been rolled out were all rolled out concurrently without any understanding of the day-to-day operation of any of the users. Oh, and by the way, every time they rolled out a new solution, they kept the old one. So when the users saw these leadership cover, we got another thing we want you to use, they would automatically cower up and just cower into a ball because they were scared to death because they were being forced to use something. I had to come and repair all those relationships, do all these things while having no support. Oh, and by the way, I was successful, but it almost cost me my life.
Yeah.
And so it changed my perspective. And as I look at intrinsics, I don't care about your salary. How is it impacting me as a human being? Am I able to get satisfaction out of the work? Right. So those are the things that are important. And so if I work somewhere and you don't understand what you have, it's highly likely I'm out. If you sold me on something and then I get in there and find out it's something else, then it's highly likely that I'm out. I've worked at companies have baited and switched me. When I find out you bait and switch me, I'm out. I've worked at companies where terrible leadership abounds in UX these days. You sound like a great leader. My current boss, dynamite boss. I've only had like 3-4 good bosses my entire career. And bosses who gaslight, they manipulate, they get engaged in all kinds of trickery. They don't support. Just, oh my God, when those things happen, I don't care. I've got, same as you, I've got a lot of short stints and I am not ashamed of any of them, because when I find out that you have lost your mind, I am going to leave. And those of you listening today, feel free to look at my LinkedIn profile. And when you see that I wasn't there long, it is safe to say that something was wrong. And I highly advise against you going there. How about we leave it at that? But go ahead, Richard.
But I want to ask you though. I mean, has it ever become a challenge for you to sort of get a job because of so many switches? And
absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to mention that too. When you have a lot of short stints, you do have to, I mean, ethics and honesty, transparency, got to be up front. Right. Everybody's going to ask me about my short stints, pretty much. I'm going to tell them what happened in a professional and in a demonstrating all diplomacy and making sure to do things in a tactful manner. But what I have found is over the course of my career, the companies that are not afraid, the companies that are confident, let me back up. I found that the companies that are confident of what they bring to the table and recognizing that your stints are not a reflection of your skill at all. They should be the people who have confidence and who understand hiring and understand what it means to the team. We got to bring Roshan because look at what this guy brings to the table. Now, the question is, you can bring anybody to the, you can bring anybody in, but you have to match that. It's like a covenant. A hiring is supposed to be a covenant. It means that both parties bring something to the table. I've got, it'd be 28 years of experience as of this year. In UX. I am skilled, as I like to explain, across all four major pillars of UX: heuristics and usability, information architecture, research, and interaction and interface design. I'm skilled across all four. I am not a jack of all trades. It's funny, people, that jack of all trades thing, the person who actually made that statement was actually endorsing that you should be a jack of all trades. He wasn't trying to say that jack of all trades, master of none. And people were starting to go back and look at that, like the Henry Ford thing. Henry Ford said that people want faster words. He never said that at all. That's people that, we just believe whatever comes out and we don't engage in critical thinking. But at any rate, the companies who they see that you bring something to the table, you bring something to the table, but they've got to bring something too. Otherwise, the covenant that we made when the hiring took place, when the offer was made and accepted, that's a covenant. And if whether people realize it or not, it is. But when the companies, when you are lying, when you boast about DEI and you only do it for the profit that comes from it, because companies found out, right, just like they found out that UX can help drive the competitive advantage of your company, they found out that boasting about DEI helps boost profits. So they did the same exact thing they did with UX. They got involved with UX, never learned UX, and then UX becomes a circus because they don't know anything. Then they blame UX. No, you never found out what UX was. And now they boast about DEI. So when you find out that the company is not DEI friendly, what's that going to mean? You know, company I worked for, and I'm going to follow your example because one of these days I will tell the whole story. That one company I worked for, I come in, I interviewed for a senior manager role. When they go to make the offer, you're going to love this. You're the first person I've told this story to, the first time I mentioned this on my show. When they go to make the offer, they go to extend the offer. Then they go, wait a minute. And they pull it back. And they say, we were told by HR that we have some budgetary issues. And so we have to change your offer. We have to downgrade your position from senior manager to manager. And I thought that it was a great opportunity. So, and I got the feeling that they wanted to approve it because they were very apprehensive because of the short stints that I had. And they didn't want to offer me that role, pay me that extra money, give me that extra bonus. And then I leave when actually I should have recognized that that was a front, because if I leave, what do you lose? If I stay, then it's a win-win. But the only way I'm going to lose or leave is if you violate what you're presenting to me now. I already know the work's going to be okay, but are you gonna play games with my mind? And so that was the first bait and switch. Then I get in, I find out it's really a glorified product designer role. It's really not UX work at all. So that's number two. Yeah. Then I find out I'm not really managing people, which is something that has been absent to a great extent in my career. And I wanted to do more. So, okay. So they kept switching. And then they turn around and the next thing you know, people appear to be offended at my skill level, commandeering my meetings, disrupting my meetings, running the people and making all of these false claims about things. Even when the person that they run to with the story was there and saw it, they were still going in and play these character assassination, as I always talk about, engage in these hefty acts of character assassination only for people who knew better to buy in. I'm not staying. I'm not staying. I can't hardly sleep because you wake up in the middle of the night thinking about all the dirty things people do to you. So it's not about the work anymore. It's the people coming to me telling me how to do my job. There, this is how you do this, and this is how you do. One person even went as far as trying to tell me how to pin chats in Teams. I didn't need you to show me that. I didn't ask you for your help, but they were trying to create a narrative that they had to tell me how to do stuff. Just barge in. There, this is how you tie your shoes. That's interesting. I don't wear shoes with laces anymore. Why are you trying to tell me about? Do you see any laces? Do you see me struggle? Do you see me walking around with untied? No, you don't. So why did you? So somebody engaged, somebody in leadership should have seen that and held those people accountable for what they were doing. Instead, they flip it because they want to make them comfortable and they put it all on me. Well, you just push me one. Every time something happened, you push me one step closer to the door. Because anybody who has an ounce of self-respect, which is my point in all of this, is not going to put up with that stuff. So if those of you out there under the sound of my voice, if you want qualified, skilled people to stay at your company, treat them with some dignity and respect. It doesn't cost you anything to do that.
Exactly.
It costs you nothing. So just do it. But I'm not going to stay if you're going to shorten my life. My wife would love the life insurance, but I think she'd rather have me.
Yeah.
Right now. Matter of fact, she heard me say that. She said, yes, I'd rather have you. She'll get the life insurance soon enough, I'm sure. But not this way. not this way. So yeah, I went on for a long time on that, but go ahead, Roshan.
No. Good points, actually. I mean, I think, yeah, because, you know, for me, I always found that as a problem with me, you know, I mean, a challenge that I have, I always thought that, you know, like it's something wrong with me that I'm not able to sort of, you know, take these sort of, you know, the corporate behaviors sort of say, you know, so, but yeah, I think it is to do with, you know, like self-respect, I think it's pretty important actually. And especially as a designer, because, you know, I think it is, if we, you know, people, I've seen, like, you know, departments and especially, you know, like the development people and, you know, people from the engineering background kind of sort of thinking of us as more of like people who can actually make things pretty. There is that perception, you know, so I think it is, yeah, and, you know, like eventually when we are able to kind of challenge that, and then, you know, the people will get, you know, offended, and they will, you know, bring things up, and, you know, things do not go well. So that happens. So, yeah.
Yep.
I think we can probably just sort of steer away from that topic. Probably that's not really that much, you know.
And it should be, I mean, we come together to collaborate, because we're going to achieve success because we come together from a multidisciplinary standpoint. All successes are going to happen because the UX people are not going to come in and save anybody from anything. We have to work together. There's the developers, the QA people, the product owners, the product managers. I mean, everybody, every skill, every concept, the project managers, the scrum masters, everybody coming together. And when we're all able to excel within our lanes, it helps to drive us forward and we get great successes. But there's so much cross lane fighting that it doesn't help. I respect everybody's discipline. I made it a point to do that. I think my old freelance work helped me to understand it, because I did everything. So it helped me to understand everybody. And then I just, you know, just respected everybody. And when I worked my old WPP world, I found that the agency life taught me, I mean, I went from Comerica Bank financial work, where we didn't have, I mean, we did all of our stuff inside. We didn't have any creative agencies that we were dealing with and things of that nature, but everybody still respected. It was a big bank and everybody respected what everybody brought to the table, and we did our work. And I never even seen the fighting before. When I was at Team Detroit, and I was part of Wonderman Digital specifically, I was part of Wonderman. We would do work, and the UX people, we did our work, and then the visual people would do their work, and the copywriter people did their work, and the QA people, and we all sort of were interwoven, and we did our thing, and there was no fighting. I found out that it differs across agencies. That even I was really shocked to see that UX maturity levels vary depending upon what agency you work at. So the agency I worked at was more mature, but then when you start getting into corporate spaces, oh my God, does it change dramatically, and the fighting is guaranteed pretty much. And so you have to manage it.
I have to say, though, I mean, there are quite a lot of smaller Indian companies here who, and, you know, I've just spoken to them also, like, you know, and I know a few of them personally, the founders and, you know, people like that. They take design and user experience very seriously.
Nice.
And there are a few organizations that have actually set up proper UX, you know, practice with very good maturity, you know, getting the right people, hiring the right people and things like that. So, even though it is, you know, like large organizations, they may not be actually as efficient as, you know, it could be because there are a lot of these, you know, kind of people, you know, toxic people still there, and they're not able to kind of, you know, kind of hindering the changes, you know, like not able to change and things like that. But there are small organizations that are actually able to set up user experience practices with good maturity and things like that. So there is hope.
Yes. That's great to hear. Very great to hear. Yeah. That makes me think, we've been talking about this a little bit. What observations about the discipline stand out to you today? You've already talked about a few of them, but it's listed here, so we got to cover it.
Sure. Yeah. And this is one thing is one thing that I've seen is that, you know, when people started doing research-based designs, right? I think when they started it, I think it was all with the good intentions and things like that, and, you know, doing it properly. But then what I've seen so far in some companies and then some, you know, few projects and, you know, products and things like that, the research is like, it's only for the name that I've seen it. Actually, it's all shortcuts and things like that, right? You know, somebody else is, you know, like, for example, Deloitte did a research. They refer the same article and then, you know, sort of without doing any primary research or directional research, they will just take that word for word and then, you know, they will just present that as, you know, sort of their own data and stuff like that. And I've seen that happening, and I've actually even cross-checked certain things, you know, like people done, and then you can figure out, hey, where this came from, right? So because they didn't even bother to kind of change the language. So there are a lot of those going on, at least in India, and people actually presenting themselves as researchers on LinkedIn and things like that are not necessarily, you know, sort of researchers. And so there is a lot of fake people. The other thing is a shift towards high fidelity first. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, just you skip the entire process of, you know, sort of, I think one of my bosses, I think, I don't remember who actually said that the fidelity of your thinking should reflect the fidelity of your design. Ooh. Right? I mean, you know, if you're not sure about certain things in your designs, then it should not be high fidelity. Otherwise, people will start, you know, sort of, you know, kind of marrying to the design, and then they will start, you know, sort of thinking that this is going to be the design. So nowadays, I see people like, you know, immediately jumping into Figma and then, you know, starting, you know, with the colors and, you know, stuff like that. And then you miss out an opportunity to test the designs and things like that with the low fidelity, you know, prototype. And that becomes a huge problem. And I think the third one is, obviously, I don't understand this obsession with AI kind of creating all these, you know, the storylines and, you know, I don't know. I think that's something we can probably talk about it afterwards. But I'm curious to see. I think you have actually also sort of talked about it quite a lot, right? I think, do you think that there is actually a decline in quality of design or deliverables, or I'm talking about from a user experience standpoint, right?
Yeah.
Do you feel like, you know, we are actually kind of celebrating mediocrity these days?
Oh my God. Understatement.
With the help of, yeah.
Understatement. Wait, I constantly refer to this as the, I don't know what they do with this in India, or if this happened in India, but there was a time when, like, this may be, some people may struggle with this example, but I'll present it in a way that I hope everybody can get it. But there was a time when in Little League sports, you had to go out, whatever the sport was, you had to go out and try out for the team. And 15, 20 kids come out, try out for the team. There's only 12 spots. So somebody's going to go home sad.
Yeah.
After all the tryouts and all the labor, and then you go and you make this. So there's one thing that's different today, because today everybody makes a team. They don't want anybody to feel bad. They don't want anybody to feel this so-called inclusion thing is actually jading expectations, and it's jading the appetite for excellence. Because now you can be a part by half doing anything.
Yeah.
And it's permeating cultures around the world. Then you play the game, say a game of soccer. This is where I hear about it happening more than anywhere else. They play soccer. One team beats the other team 26-0. The kids get stomped. Now, the kids who played 26-0, their coach is grilling them and making them do all type of stuff. You better beat them 26-0 because they're not very good. And then the other ones, they get stomped, and then they leave, and they're celebrated. They gave no effort. There was no expertise. Nobody's committed to anything. And then they go, all right, we lost. Let's go get ice cream and pizza or whatever. And then, so you basically, the mindset is that of the participation trophy, that you did nothing, you accomplished nothing, you presented nothing of value, but yet we're going to reward you. Yeah. And this is something that we started to see when I was a teenager. It started. I was an all-star little league baseball player. But on the team I played with, first time ever, because I played little league before this and it didn't happen. You try out for the team, you either make the team or you don't. And if you make the team, you either start or you're on the bench. And if you're on the bench, you may or may not get into the game. If you don't play, nobody's going to cry. If you cry, you're going to cry alone. If you want to play, get better. and then your parents had to send you to camps so you could get better in the whole nine yards. And I think my parents ended up being angry later, regretting that they didn't send me to some of those camps because they lost millions of dollars, which I would have given them had they sent me to camp. But anyway, and I was this far from making it. But at any rate, by the time I played on that Lily baseball team, there were 16 of us on the team. All 16 people played every game. Matter of fact, all 16, because there's nine positions on the baseball team. All 16 people batted. Everybody batted. And I remember, oh, so-and-so is about to go bat. Oh, there's two outs. Grab your gloves. We're about to go out back out. He's not going to get a hit. He can't even see the ball. So that was when I played when you had to make it. And then I played again when it was this participation trophy thing. And it's really sad that I have found that today that has advanced even more. And now you have this sense of entitlement. Everybody feels that they're entitled to everything they know. And the big thing today, especially with this gatekeeping mindset that a lot of people have, they don't want to be told. You mentioned it earlier. They act like they know something when they know that they don't. And then when somebody tells them that they don't know or tries to give them some constructive criticism, they reject it. And then they talk about gatekeeping. Anybody who has a fear of gatekeeping, it's not a legit concept, like imposter syndrome. But if you're afraid of it, you'll never learn. Because gatekeeping is nothing more than quality advocacy. And when you get educated, what's happening? You're being exposed to quality, and you're being held accountable and measured by that quality. So the whole a proper educational process is an act of gatekeeping as well. Much needed gatekeeping. So we struggle. I think we struggle. That's why I remember Vitamin T did that research back in like 2017 or so, saying that every experience out there, only 97% of experiences actually have problems with them, according to the research that they did. 97%.
Okay.
And so I tell my students all the time, strive to be part of the three. Do everything you can to strive to be a part of the 3%. Because actually, that was 97% in 2017. It's worse today.
Yeah.
It's worse today because people do things just to get by. Like you mentioned, they want to come out, break out with the high fidelity stuff right out the bat.
Yeah.
We don't even know what the requirements are. How can you? And then those which design is better posts, which have zero context. And I started posting that. I don't know. What's the context? I'm not going to judge this just based on what you said or what you posted here. What's the context of this thing? Let's start where we should start. And, you know, that didn't happen. So, yeah, quality is going to be until there is a commitment to quality. I say that UX is on a downward spiral right now. Is there hope? Yes. Yes, there's hope. But we're not in a good way. Yeah. We're not in a good way. But things seem to be starting to, I'm starting to see a little glints of hope here and there, and more people that have more of a passion, more of an appetite for things that are done the right way, which is really more what user experience is about anyway. The attitudes and the perceptions is more critical to UX than the whether or not you can use Figma. That's not.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so.
Yeah, yeah, so that's my I do see some hope, though. I mean, I still have to, you know, like I've worked with enough young people, and I have seen, you know, so a lot of people who have that appetite to sort of, you know, do things the right way. And I've seen that also. But it's just there's also this percentage of people who are, you know, currently senior, kind of, you know, in a positions where they would still probably just, you know, directly jump into the designs without, you know, doing a proper research. Funny though, I mean, I think when you were speaking, I was thinking about something that happened because I've had, I worked with somebody who sort of, you know, did an interview for, you know, did a few user interviews. So we divided the user interview between, you know, a few of the people that we were actually working with. And when at the time of synthesis, we were actually looking at the transcript. This particular person actually sent us the transcript, which was exactly the same copy for all three interviews he took. The transcripts are the same. So, and then he was at a senior manager at that time, you know, sort of. And then there are people with that kind of, you know, carelessness with, I think the guy was like 15, 16 years of experience, right? Wow. And that guy is kind of doing it. So there are people like that also. And then, you know, and when we point out things like that, you know, it's nothing happens because, you know, people will just say, hey, that's what he did. I mean, you know, he probably transcribed it. That's what he got from the, you know, transcription. But then, you know, we went there and then listened to the recordings, and then that's not the users actually sent. So, you know, there are things like that also.
My goodness. You just reminded me of a story, something I witnessed not too long ago. A person who's running, senior manager, it's like in your story, said that she had 8 years of experience. When I looked at the profile, that's not what I saw, but what I saw was more what the person did, not what they were claiming. And the person we were talking to, some stakeholders, and this person literally asked them, okay, we're going to do some research. How many stakeholder or how many participants would you like us to research? What? You kept trying to tell me what to do so you could try to make it look like you know more than me because you're threatened by me, obviously. You literally asked the stakeholder, so how many people do you want us to research? And I went, oh, no, no, we don't do that. We don't do that. That's determined by the type of research you do. You know, but yeah, these are the same people that want to ask people what they want and then act like they did something. So this has to be straightened out. And I think it's a U.S. leadership problem it starts when the company forms their UX team. Been talking about this a lot lately. If you hire the wrong person to run your UX team, everything after that is going to be garbage. I've seen teams, I don't know how they start badly and then they try to fix it. They realize they start to see their gaps. Honesty starts to peek its head out of the ground just a little bit. We need to bring somebody here that knows what's going on. I've been hired to teams like that. And I was going to come in and become this new voice of reason that the team never had before. Only for the people who preceded me, they didn't expect that their own experience was going to have holes poked in it. Not purposely. I didn't go around trying to find things, but I just kept talking and they got sick of it. And then next thing you know, I'm getting attacked from all these different angles because of how I made them feel. Well, you know, maybe he shouldn't have lied to management and told him he had 9 years of UX experience when this was actually his first UX job. In one instance, that's really what happened. And this is your first UX job. And the person would go out of their way to try to make me feel like they were schooling me on things. And I mean, out of the blue, not because I did anything that caused it. They just swung in on a rope like Tarzan and then try to create this narrative. I'm going, no, that's not how this works. I remember working at a company and I was frustrated and UX people do gain support from other UX people when things go crazy. You should be able to talk to somebody else. When you talk to a stakeholder, exactly. I see you nod your head. When something goes crazy, you expect to be able to go back and talk to the other UXers about what happened. We comfort one another. We encourage one another. We go back out and we do it again. We got to talk to somebody. And I was, something happened with a stakeholder. I had never had an interaction with that particular stakeholder again. I was a little frustrated about it. I was going to, you know, be fine. I didn't demonstrate anything with the stakeholder. I didn't get unprofessional. They didn't even know that I was frustrated, but I was frustrated. So I came back to talk to the UX people because that's what I'm used to doing. So that's what I was going to do. And then he says, you finally experienced the frustration, huh? Like again, I'm not even saying what he actually said to me. It was very risque language that he used to describe someone who had just lost their, how do we say, someone who just had their first experience of a certain sort. That was the way he started talking to me. And I looked and I knew what he meant. Are you kidding me, dude? Are you kidding me? You know my background. You know that this is not the first time. But I just got to this company and that I had a little bit of a rude awakening of what was going to happen within this company and trying to do the right thing. But I was brought in to help drive the UX maturity level. So on one hand, I was shocked.
Yeah.
I was shocked, but I was more frustrated than I was shocked. And I thought that since they had been seeing this, that they might shed some light on some things with me, and maybe help me to understand that stakeholder a little bit so I could come up with a strategy to go back and get things done the right way. But instead, he used it as an opportunity to try to create this weird narrative. And that I'm going to start a narrative on a challenge to the UX community. So those of you under the sound of my voice right now, you want to see where you are from a personal UX maturity perspective. You have to be able to interact and engage in a fruitful and practical manner with senior UXers. If anybody who cannot engage and interact with a true, not the people who say they are, there's a lot of people say they're seniors, they're not seniors. You know, going back, used to have at least 7 years before you, in some cases 10, before you would be considered to be a senior. Mid-level was this big, gigantic window. And at one time in this one, now you got people getting senior like after 6 months and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's it's not right. And that creates problems. So,
I know of somebody who got promoted at Amazon after just having 4 years of experience as a manager, not even as a senior.
Wow. I mean, yeah.
And so.
God, no.
So, you know, and she had the wisdom though. I mean, she said no. And then she joined another company as a senior game designer.
Wow.
Yeah, she said, like, I'm not ready.
Amazing. So, yep. Amazing for her. That doesn't happen. That just simply does not happen. Let me get that person. some applause, man. You know, but to the people who accept the senior role before they're ready. So a little shout out on both ends with that. It's because the person gets the paycheck, they get the job, they get the prestige, they get the pride, and then they throw a monkey wrench into the discipline.
Yeah.
In the process, because they they don't live up to the title, and you have 50 leaders walk by you and they see your title and they have an expectation and it gets blown. They wonder why they sweep in and lay everybody off because somebody somewhere contributed to that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so that's the if that's the kind of the maturity in organizations like that, I think you can imagine what's going on with all these companies that they have have laid off a lot of people. I mean, that's
garbage.
It's easy to imagine.
Yeah. Roshan, we have been talking already for quite some time. We got to do this again. I'm gonna end with my standard question, but we got to redo this again because we had some topics we didn't get to cover. I know you wanted to talk about the role of AI and UX, and you want to talk about system thinking. So let's get together again soon and do that again. Anniversary shows. Sure. The people who've been on the show are coming up again soon, so maybe we can line something up then. But we're gonna wrap up today with our final question. What advice do you have for up and comers in the discipline? I know you said a lot of great stuff that fits into this already, but what would be your sign off message to folks?
Okay. So think of, the first thing is user-centered design. I don't know, learn the methodology properly. That covers, and it's been around for a long time, and that thing works. That methodology works, right? So if you're in don't be sort of don't show your ego. Just own up to the things that you don't know, and sort of learn the user-centered design methodology properly.
Yep,
that will get you so far, because I don't think there is no other way around it actually. And if you have interest in other things like human behavior, psychology and things like that, yes, you can get a little bit more, more into that, and then, probably just help sort of grow the discipline. But I think the basics of it is everything is laid out in the user-centered design methodology. Yep. Follow that. I think that's the first advice that I'll give anybody who is getting into the UX profession and research-based design. And I've heard a lot of people actually talking about data-driven design, and people tend to think that data-driven design is only just looking at the analytics and then designing to solve that analytics problem or whatever they are actually seeing in the analytics, right? So I think it's much more than that. I think it's about the using both quantitative and qualitative solving that for, using the quantitative and qualitative data to solve the problems.
Yes.
So I think, that UCD actually helps with that. So that's my kind of, the advice.
Excellent. Excellent. Totally agree. Great stuff.
Yeah.
So folks, thank you, Roshan, for taking the time to meet with me today and to be on the show. A lot of power pack stuff here that you shared with the audience. And again, we got to get that set up soon, and we can have some other discussions here. But folks, that is all the time that we have for today. Thanks to all of you out there who take the time to listen to The World of UX. Again, share this with other people that you know really want to embrace and get involved with UX passionately, genuinely, love the discipline, get involved. We're going to be here to share information with you that's always going to help to vault you forward the right way. And with all the misinformation that's out here today, what you tap into is indeed critical, and your trajectory will always match the quality of your intake. Remember that. All right, folks. So that's all the time that we have today. So for my guest, Roshan Ravi, and for me, Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX, until next time, happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio.
Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.